Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Wentworth Douglas Hospital Portsmouth Outpatient Center provides this community with innovative treatments, top doctors and nurses, and an ever-expanding list of services. Learn more at wdhospital.org/Portsmouth and experience better.
This is Alex Lacasse, reporter with Seacoast Online and the Exeter Newsletter. We're taking a look at the Tammy Belanger disappearance, which occurred 35 years ago on November 13th, 1984. I'm here with Steve Stevens. He was the Exeter Newsletter reporter at the time, and he was kind enough to join us. So, Steve, welcome, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Alex.
And I guess just for starters, can you just tell me about your experience at the time of reporting in Exeter and just kind of what was going on in town or kind of leading up to this disappearance?
Sure. I started at the newsletter, actually as a part-time reporter in January of that year, covering the town of Newmarket, city town council meetings, things like that, sewer, that fun stuff that all of us small town reporters do.
Kind of in the Newmarket, it's always funny just because it's kind of in like the nether region between Durham and Foster's world and then the Portsmouth Herald world. So
exactly, and at the time Foster's was a bitter competitor. And so we were competing for the Newmarket. We were kind of trying to expand into Newmarket more than we had been. Not that it has anything to do with Tammy. But anyways, they must have liked me just enough that they actually hired me as the sports editor at that time a weekly newsletter.
Yes.
And I think we published on Wednesdays, if I recall. But anyways, I was a sports editor. So it was a glorified sports reporter position, basically. And at the time, I was the sports editor. When in November, we found out there was a girl missing, hadn't appeared at school. And I was just going about my normal business, probably interviewing an athlete or something. And my editor, Mary Kroner at the time, said, we need you to go to the police station and inquire about this. And I'm like, okay. And I was thrown into it.
Was that kind of your first...
It was my first news story of any sort, and it happened to just be the biggest one we probably had in decades. And let's just say the reporter that covered Exeter news was not available. Let's leave it at that. So I jumped in, and next thing you know, reporting on the worst story I've ever in my entire 30-year career covered, and it just happened to be in my first year there.
Can you kind of take me through that day? So you said that you had heard that this girl was missing, and from the research I've done, it seemed like back then it wasn't parents wouldn't call ahead when their student was sick or anything.
No. Back then there was no formal policy of... most of us, like from Stratum, would had the bus, and so as the student got on the bus, the student carefully and always got home, got to the school and back. Well, Tammy, like a lot of the Exeter kids, because she didn't live far from the school, on River Street, and she walked to school every day, and is what she did this time. But back then they didn't have a policy at any in this Exeter school system to account for kids. I mean, I don't mean to make them sound like they didn't know what they were doing, because they did, but it was a different time.
Right, it wasn't a concern as much.
Kids didn't get kidnapped back then, for the most part. And so, anyway, so what we found out was we started getting a little scuttlebutt, because the office for Exeter Newsletter used to be downtown Exeter at the time, right near, several blocks away from where we're talking. And we were getting a lot of scuttlebutt that there was parents were concerned that their girl had not returned home from school, and then they find out she had never made it to school. And so my editor said, can you go down to the police station, and find out what's going on. And so that's actually when I, for the first time, I met Frank Caracciola, who was the chief, the police chief. And it actually started a good relationship between us over the years. But he really didn't have much to say at the time. And so then former owners of the newsletter, who still worked there at the time, had connections with the family. And he helped me, I think, if I recall correctly, get me into the family's home. And
was it that same day?
No, it was the next day
after. Okay, the next day after.
Yeah.
For those immediate days following, kind of what was kind of the law enforcement response, and then I guess going to meet the parents as well?
The police, I think it started about that afternoon when the police found out that the parents reported that Tammy had not gotten to school. Mm-hmm. And so at first, if I recall correctly, the police thought, oh, well, she's probably hung out with some friends, and she was only 8 years old, so I mean, I don't know how much trouble she could have gotten into.
Right.
But I guess they kind of surmised, because God knows they probably deal with a lot far worse things, not of kidnapping, but of children that may be truants. And they thought probably, if I understand correctly, that she had just kind of taken the day off or something. And so anyway, but then it started getting serious when she didn't return home. And the next several days, it was just police everywhere, anything that had to do with emergency response, were, I'd say, combing that path that she would have taken to school. There were helicopters in the friggin' air. It was just unbelievable. The response was pretty overwhelming, at least for that day and age.
Okay. I guess we can revisit the parents.
We can revisit after whatever you
yes.
want.
And then as this investigation is unfolding, just what was it like just to be a part of that every day? Was that just kind of your everyday reality from that point?
It became that, although I still had to do some sports stuff.
Yes.
They'd have some press conferences and such, and you'd have to go to that at the public state, at the police complex. And it was just, it was kind of like big city had come into, because the big city organizations were, over the next couple of days, coming into Little Exeter from Boston and from elsewhere. And it was quite a scene, to be honest. And it was a little overwhelming for little old me, who was only probably about your age, is my guess. I was 24.
Okay.
And it was an overwhelming experience, and it's something that I've, some of the stuff is fuzzy, but the one overwhelming feeling I had was that, well, I can't believe this is happening. And I think that's how the whole community felt at the time. But here I was, a sports guy, just started the paper, and here I'm covering the biggest story that's probably happened in this community in forever.
When you're kind of attending all these things and you're living this every day, did you ever get a sense, talking with people on off the record, that they were getting close? Did you ever think they had that breakthrough?
No, there wasn't any sense of that at all. In fact, and I let's just say there were various theories floating around at the time. I mean, obviously we still don't know what the answer was.
Right.
But I think I get the sense that they kind of know, no one had any clue. There was no breakthroughs that they made aware to us. In hindsight, it sounds like they kind of figured out a few days into it that it might have been this Victor Wanyeti guy, but that obviously we know was never proven.
So you mentioned the parents. So you're a young reporter. It's your first year on the job. Mm-hmm. Just what's that like going into this family's living room?
It was a heart-wrench. Even then, I recognized how heart-wrenching it was. And I was just a little punk reporter, I was invited into their home. I got to just sit there and stand there with the mother, Pat and Nelson, Belanger, mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
I think there were some aunts and uncles, and I think the younger folk were kind of not there. They were probably there somewhere, but they weren't mixed in with us. And they're just people coming and going, and police were there, and all kinds of community officials were there. And it was just an overwhelmingly, frankly, sad, yet hopeful time, because it was still very early. And the parents were very hopeful, as were the other members of the family and their friends, that, well, it's really early and there's got to be a rational reason for this. It had to be a good reason. And I just remember the mom kind of walking in and out of the room and she was unbelievably gracious considering the situation. I felt like I was an intruder. But that's what you did, you mm-hmm. know? And they were so gracious to let me be there that, and the one overwhelming feeling was of love and concern and of great hope. I don't know, but I saw it. That was my one chance to really hang around with them. Obviously, why would they want me to be there?
Right.
But I think they were hoping that we as a news organization, because we were a beloved entity, not that we aren't now still, but we were such an ingrained part of that community I think they really were hoping we were the coverage and what I could give of what they were feeling and thinking, and that maybe somehow that would reach out to whoever might have taken her.
I guess looking back on that, you're, I think, one of the only journalists who's actually spoken with the family, and...
To my knowledge, I may be the only one.
Yes, and I haven't seen any interviews they've done over the years or anything in my research. So I guess just when you look back on that now, in today, you know, 35 years later, this case is still unsolved.
Yeah.
Did you ever think that it could take on this kind of life of its own?
No, it's kind of mythic in the most. It's an American tragedy, obviously, no, I think we thought she will find her.
Mm-hmm.
As the days wore on, initially we thought we'll find her. You know, we'll find. I say we. I mean the people who are actually doing the hard work. That they would find her, and initially hoped and thought probably alive. And then as the days went on, it seemed more likely that we still thought they'd find her,
mm-hmm.
but probably not alive. And because then they were like getting, you know, over the years there were all kinds of, you know, like draining the ponds and digging up the graves and things like that. But even in the early moments, there was like, oh my God, you know, there was talk, and again, it's not like I somehow was a fly on the wall in the police strategy room or something, but from what the impression I get from the chief was that there was a lot of tips being reported, and that somebody had seen her supposedly, you know, I don't remember where, but I do remember they had seen her supposedly. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really did. A lot of little girls look alike. And near, you know, a pond or whatever, and there was talk about draining ponds even back then. And I know that they did scour the river, because the river was near their family home, the Exeter River. And I do know that they canvassed that river a lot.
Yeah, my parents lived in Exeter at the time, and they said they remember the river being drained.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. So initially we thought we'd find her, and first alive, and then probably not alive. And then life goes on again, you know.
Yeah.
And then I remember in this succeeding years, there'd be the occasional tip, like, oh yeah, she was, you know, we think somebody thought she was buried in a grave that had been dug during that period when she disappeared, and somebody saw her backpack and things like that. Supposedly saw her backpack.
Yes.
And none of them proved to be anything, unfortunately. But the adrenaline, every time we'd get a little tip that this was going on, the adrenaline gets going again, and all the memories flash forward again. And nothing ever good came of it.
Okay. And was there one moment when you got a sense that the case had gone completely cold?
Not any one moment.
Mm-hmm.
I think just time, it's like life moves on, and the police had, I know at some point I think within the year had said it was essentially a cold case, and that the search had stopped quite I don't remember when it was, to be honest. It was within weeks, if not... Within weeks, they had more or less stopped searching for her.
Okay.
If that was the impression I had gotten. Mm-hmm. But there was no one moment, no.
Alrighty.
So, like you mentioned previously, there you heard a lot of theories over who may have abducted Tammy. From everything you heard, have you personally come up with your own theory? Do you, in fact, believe it was this Victor Wanyeti that a lot of law enforcement seems to think?
What if the evidence is actually evidence that I've read about and heard about over the years, then yeah, it was probably him. But do I know that? No, I don't know that. Sure, it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? At least that's how I look at it. It makes a lot of sense. There's a lot of coincidences, but a lot of common sense tells me yes, it was probably Victor Wanyeti.
Overall, you spent the better part of 30 years reporting here on the Seacoast. Mm-hmm. A lot of that time spent in Exeter. What do you think this case had as an impact on the Exeter community, and do you think they're still feeling the pain of it today?
I think the people like me that were around in the day are probably, I mean, again, life moves on, and life is an interesting thing. But when you called me up the other day, Tammy Blanger, I'm like, that name has a resonance within me that I can't fully describe. Takes me back to a very important time in my life, personally, and takes me back to a time when the community was, I think, a far different community than it is now. And it was much smaller. And I think it was more tight-knit. It's just by its nature. I think it's this whole area has grown up so much, there's so much influx of people from other areas that I think the tight-knittedness is no longer there. But I think the community has changed so much that probably it's not as resonant now with the people that are there. But those of us who lived through it, yeah, we'll never forget it. I don't even know if I really answered your question, but you can ask it again.
No, absolutely.
Feel free to make me sound more intelligent than I do.
I thank you for taking the time, Steve, and certainly it was great catching up with you, and appreciate all your work that you've done in the community for all these years.
You know, the one thing I would say is that, as I said, when you called me, and Tammy Blanger, and first thing that comes to my mind, and always has since from that moment, was the 8-year-old Tammy Blanger disappeared on her way to school back in November of 1984. And that's how I think of her, and of all the pictures of her plastered on all the windows and all of the shops. And the utter tragic and unfairness of all this is that I wish I had never heard of Tammy Blanger, or at least I had never heard of her until maybe years later when she was in Exeter High School, and maybe I would have been fortunate enough to have interviewed her, after she scored the game-winning goal for the Exeter High soccer team or something like that, and then that's how I would have liked to have learned about her, because it's such an intense, sad feeling to hear her name, and I wish it weren't so.
Absolutely.
Anyways, right. Thank you.
Well, I thank you for joining me, Steve, and it's been great to learn about your experience reporting on quite this groundbreaking and like you said, a sad American story.
Yeah, thank you.
Absolutely.
Just gonna run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.